This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Tanya Mosley. In celebration of hip-hop's 50th anniversary, we're featuring interviews from our archive with some of the genre's groundbreaking performers. Our guest today is Questlove Amir Thompson. He co-founded the hip-hop group The Roots, which is also the house band for The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon. Questlove has described The Roots as the last hip-hop group, the last of a dying breed in an era of solo acts. Questlove grew up in West Philadelphia, but spent a lot of time on the road traveling with his father, the late Lee Andrews, of the doo-wop group Lee Andrews and the Hearts. Lee Andrews' record collection gave Questlove a head start in becoming an encyclopedia of music references. We'll start with Terry's 2013 interview with Questlove. He had just published his memoir, Mo Meta Blues.
Amir, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to have you back. Growing up with rap music and hip-hop, did you ever worry that the music you loved wouldn't have use for a drummer like you because of drum machines, because of sampling?
Never. I break down hip-hop in sort of like five-year brackets. The first period of hip-hop, which is 1977 to 1982, was pretty much the idea, at least on wax, because of technology restrictions, the DJ would play the house band of the label that they were signed to. So let's say it's Sugar Hill Records. Grandmaster Flash would play, let's say, a particular break, like let's say Get Up and Dance or the Apache break, like a well-known break that he would spin in clubs. He would play it for the house band, which was Keith LeBlanc on drums and Doug Wimbush on bass, and they would approximate it. So I meant the first 5 years of hip-hop were interpreted by a live band. And so, you know, it didn't sound foreign to me at all. When drum machines came in, and then when sampling came in, especially in the age of Public Enemy's records, pretty much I just heard my father's entire record collection kind of amalgamated in these, you know, 60-minute cassettes. Like, probably the most seminal moment for me is Public Enemy's It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. When that album came out in 1988, that was a Sgt. Pepper's moment. That was a Never Mind the Bullocks, Here Comes the Sex Pistols moment. And what they did was, I mean, they made a sound collage of my father's record collection. So at first it was a Name That Tune thing, like, oh, okay, that's David Bowie, that's Funkadelic, that's James Brown. But then, you know, it was contextualized in a way that I could relate to. So I didn't feel a threat like, oh, I don't know how to fit in this world.
So your father's era, I mean, there's a lot of showmanship, and you talk about, like, you had to get the clothes pressed and use the right colored gels for the lights. You know, it was a sense of, like, you know, performance, showmanship, and polish. Whereas in hip-hop, I mean, a lot of performers are into, like, you know, street credibility and
right. Just
like the baggy jeans and the hoodie. And at the same time, though, there's a lot of showmanship. I mean, there's so many hip hop groups that have, you know, extravagant stage shows and like dozens of dancers behind them
right. And
incredible choreography.
Well, in the beginning, like, mind you, hip hop and I kind of grew up together. So, you know, in 77, I was 6 years old. So by the time that Rapper's Delight came out, and the first wave of groups from that era were getting national exposure, like doing shows, opening for the Commodores and opening for a Cameo and that type of stuff that I got to witness. You know, I was 10 years old, and those initial acts, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, the Cold Crush Brothers, the Fantastic Romantic, the Treacherous Three, believe it or not, those groups were more derivative of 70 soul groups. So they had the mentality that they had to be like the Temptations, like Blue Magic, like the Main Ingredient, like a lot of these 70s groups. So, you know, often in their shows, they too would do singing routines. They do dancing routines. They wore flashy outfits. You know, the king of the 70s, in my opinion, as far as taking black theater to the highest level was George Clinton and him bringing theater and that type of visual wonderment to the stage. These groups, these initial groups ate it up, which is precisely the reason why Russell Simmons kind of pressed the red panic button and said, wait a minute, you know, this isn't real hip hop. Like, you guys are just basing your act of off these 70s groups with these flashy outfits. You guys look like Earth, Wind & Fire. So the appeal of Run DMC and the idea of the street mentality is sort of, you have to imagine, the same thing that Kurt Cobain did for the grunge movement, kind of wiping the slate clean from hair metal and all the glam associated with that. That's what Run DMC did to the hip-hop that came before it. Russell Simmons said that hip-hop should be guys next door. The people that you see on your corner, you should look like them. And for all this musicianship, no. It should just be very simple drums and voice. And so that is what ushers in the hip-hop as we know it, as far as street credibility. But before 1982, no. I mean, you know, hip-hop bands felt they had to compete with Earth, Wind & Fire and P-Funk.
So where did you see yourself fitting in when you started to perform?
I didn't. I was strictly a fan. And it wasn't until De La Soul came aboard. I think before De La Soul, I saw myself fitting more into the music that Prince was putting out. His particular period at that point, you know, he had massive success with Purple Rain. Then he was sort of going through this hippie jazzy period in the mid 80s that I really that I thought he could do no wrong. And it really wasn't until De La Soul came out. De La Soul is a trio from Long Island that, you know, dressed in their parents' clothes. They wore their hair in these outlandish styles, and they were sampling the music that you would normally ignore. Like, who's going to put Harry Nilsson in a hip-hop song? And so once they came out in 1989 with 3 Feet High and Rising, then I just knew, like, okay, this is my calling. Like, that was my moment.
Your new book is a year-by-year history of songs that have special significance for you since your year of birth in 1971. For 1988, you write about Public Enemy's album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, which is a pivotal record for a lot of people. I think it was maybe especially pivotal for you, both in terms of, like, music, but also changing the course of your life. You were working at a 50s-themed fast food place in Philly?
Big Al's.
Where was that?
It was on Penn's campus on 34th and Walnut. All I can simply say is that I think every teenager has that one moment in his life or her life or their life in which the possibilities of what life has to offer is shown to you, and it's up to you to accept that mission or to ignore that mission.
Well, how did that album tell you that you needed to change the direction of your life and quit your job at Big Al's?
Okay, so what makes Public Enemy one of the most important artists ever is the fact that In one fell swoop, they literally made my dad's entire record collection cool, because their pop art, Jackson Pollock method of just throwing paint on the wall and watching these colors blend in with each other, that's how they treated records. So I'm listening to their music, and it's like, wait a minute, that's David Bowie. Wait a minute, that's George Clinton. That's James Brown. That's the Commodores. That's the Barqués. Like, I listened to it one down to see, like, how many sound bites could I recognize from my dad's record collection. And once I went over 100, I was like, wait a minute. This is my dad's record collection in one record. It's like a catalog. I can do this. But it was done in a way in which it just didn't sound like, it wasn't like they were mirroring back my dad's record collection. It was like they filtered it and made it sound urgent. And it was like hearing, I could imagine it was like what it was like to hear the Sex Pistols or Bad Brains or punk music for the first time. Like, I had that for me. And when I got to work, I couldn't stop thinking about that record. And when I went on my lunch break, I never went back. I just sat in the park and listened to that record for 4 hours. And I said to myself, this is what I want to do with my life. Like, I want to make a kid quit his job and change his life direction. This is what I want to do. Like, not just like make music or get a record deal. Like, the way that music made me do those things, this is when I said, this is my direction.
Well, you were already playing with the Roots, right?
We were a year into it, but, you know, I mean, to be honest with you, the Roots kind of started with a lie. Like, I was just trying to impress a girl that I liked in high school, and I was just thinking off the top of my head, I got a group with that guy. And, you know, I ran up to Tariq like, yo, we got a group in case blah, 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 I ask you, all right? And Tariq was like baffled, like, huh? Yeah, we got a group. And then that's kind of how it was. Like, we just freestyle at lunch period. Like, we did one talent show, and Boyz II Men got all the attention and all the girls crying in the audience and all those things. And, you know, so I didn't truly expect. Like, I was going to follow my father's dream. My father wanted me to go to Curtis Music Institute. He, in his mind, like, going to classical, the classical route and making, you know, you could make $100,000 a year playing classical music. You know, that was, like, respectable, which is why people always ask me, is it true you really didn't tell your dad about the Roots until the second album? And it's like, yeah, because, you know, this is you defying your parents, defying your father. My mother hates when I tell that story because she doesn't want the world to think that she didn't encourage me. She did encourage me, but, you know, to tell your dad you're not going to go to Juilliard and you're going to get a record deal with your high school friend, like, that isn't the reason why he, like, you know, busted his behind to put you in the best schools to, you know, to quit to do rap music, end quote. So, but yeah, I heard that record and it just absolutely, that was my Moses come to the mountain moment in my life.
So which track from It Takes a Nation of Millions best illustrates your father's record collection?
His absolute disdain for the track Rebel Without a Pause. He thought it was a tea kettle going off and just thought it was absolute noise. And, you know, little did he know that was just his beloved James Brown loop or being repetitive. And, you know, he couldn't argue with me there.
Okay, so let's hear it.
Yes, the rhythm, the rebel. Without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhyme, where you never been, I'm in. You want styling? You know it's time again. D, the enemy, telling you to hear it. They praise the music, it's time to play the lyrics. Some say no to the album, the show. Bum rush the sound I made a year ago. I guess you know, you guess I'm just a radical. Not on sabbatical, yes, to make it critical. The only part of your body should be part of it too. Pair the power on the hour from the rebel to you.
Hey, yo, Chuck, man, I don't understand this, man. Yo, you got this money out, man, you're losing them.
Radio, suckers never play me. All the mix, they just okay me now. Knowing and grown, when the clock in my zone is known, sneaking and taking.
That was Rebel Without a Pause from Public Enemy's second album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Now we're going to hear an excerpt of Terry's 1997 interview with Chuck D, leader of Public Enemy. One of their best-known songs, Fight the Power, was used in Spike Lee's movie Do the Right Thing. This interview was recorded when Chuck D's book, Fight the Power, Rap, Race, and Reality, came out. First, let's listen to Public Enemy's Power to the People.
And you thought the beat slowed down, come on! Turn me loose! Just turn it up!
internationally known on the microphone, making sure the brothers will never leave you alone. To my sisters, sisters, yes, we missed ya. Let's get it together, make a nation. You can bet on it, don't sleep in it, cause the truth's so deep in it.
Chuck D, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I'm all right.
In your new book, you point out that most rap artists were born after 1967, whereas everyone in your group was born between 1958 and 61. How do you think that makes your point of view different in your lyrics?
I just think I was able to visualize the whole decade of the 60s, and I definitely was a recipient of all the surrounding events. So when 1986 came around, and it was the 10th year, I guess, of rap music, sort of, or the 7th year of recording, the topics were in me, and I didn't have to really go into trying to discover them in depth as much as, you know, some of the younger guys. So I went into something that that was relative to myself.
Public Enemy is also known for its layered sound mixes. How did that become a part of the group?
The processes of trying to invent something that was different, trying to be as diverse as possible, and coming from a background of many different musical styles, which we believe that hip-hop is a blend and a hybrid of all kinds of musics. And, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, I was more into sports. So when I did listen to music and I listened to radio, I listened to pretty much AM pop radio. So you heard everything from the Rolling Stones to Love and Spoonful, Chicago, the Spinners, Elton John, things like that. So that combination allowed us to come up with weird layering blends.
Tell me about creating the image of Public Enemy, how you dressed, what you did on stage, what the look was on stage.
Well, the look was on stage was like kind of represent some of the look on the streets, but what the S1Ws had done is, you know, take a combination of a Fruit of Islam and Black Panther Party look with the berets and the black suits. And actually, they had dressed that way to be, you know, they were security for our mobile gigs that we used to have out in Long Island. So when they actually, you know, when we actually put this group together, myself and Hank Shockley thought that they would be a good component to the group to add a look, and that they did. Flavor and myself wore regular street gear. You know, we started out wearing these little clocks because that was the style of high school kids at the time. And then Flavor just kept, you know, wearing his clock as the clocks got bigger. I took my clock off after the first year. But, you know, the clock signified what time it was, which meant that, you know, you had to know what was happening.
So tell me more about the image of having bodyguards on stage.
Well, they wasn't really bodyguards. Security, the first world, signified, well, had a double meaning. It was like they would call themselves security of the first world because, you know, we felt that we as black people were first world people. And security, you know, spoke up for the fact that our culture, our language, our whole background and known black background was taken away from us. And the security of the first world or a symbol to present the fact that we would never allow it to, you know, happen again. And, you know, there was also a symbol because in the beginning, you know, the S1Ws held Uzis. And the Uzi signified, you know, the whole aspect of black culture was stolen with the threat of the gun used by the Western Hemisphere and the European civilization. And when they used the gun to abduct us from a land that we pretty much, you know, were peaceful and civil at, then we used it as a symbol as the S1Ws being the security of the first world, not allowing this to happen again in symbol.
Were they real Uzis or fake Uzis?
Next question.
Uh-oh. Sorry, you can't answer that? Why can't you answer that?
Because I choose not to.
All right. you know, that's a kind of elaborate metaphor that you're using for the Uzis, but I think the way they've really been seen is these guys are really tough. They've got guns. They're really macho.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the way you'd see it if you were in the audience, as opposed to an elaborate metaphor about how the culture was stolen.
I think number one is that, you know, people were shocked at that time. They had never seen black organization like this in that particular type of way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, black men in uniforms. They don't look like they're in the Army or the U.S. Navy or anything. They just look like they're in it for themselves.
Let me play one of the better known, you know, one of the most popular raps from Public Enemy, and this is Don't Believe the Hype. Just before we hear it, what are some of the things that you were reacting against in this particular track?
You know, just telling people don't fall victim to being programmed. Not saying don't believe anything, but challenge information. I mean, even today, we're in just as much of a misinformation age as we are in an information age. So you have to be able to challenge the so-called fact with some situations or some background and research before you actually believe it. In this country right here in the United States, you know, people here are still a headline soaking in audience, so to speak. And instead of the headline, get into the story.
Well, let's hear Don't Believe the Hype. This is Public Enemy. My guest is Chuck D., the lead vocalist of the group.
Don't. Here's what I want you all to do for me.
Bang. Caught you looking for the same thing. It's a new thing. Check out this I bring. Uh-oh, the roll below the level, cause I'm living low next to the bass.
Come on.
Turn up the radio. They're claiming I'm a criminal. But now I wonder how. Some people never know. The enemy could be the friend guardian. I'm now a hooligan. I rock the party and clear all the madness. I'm not a racist. Preach to teach the
cause some they never had this.
Number one. Never wanna run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one. The minute they see me, fear me. I'm the epitome of public enemy. Used, abused without clues. I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
Yes.
My guest is Chuck D. of Public Enemy, and he's written a new book called Fight the Power, Rap, Race, and Reality. I'm wondering if the murders of Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur had a big personal effect on you, and also if they've had an effect on how, on performing, and how you see other people.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, it's just a ridiculous concept that we had two of the guys at the top, Mr. One and Mr. 1A, and they were both murdered, shot. They haven't found the killers. It's just uncanny. It's just unbelievable. And that's no pun intended, because that was one of Biggie's songs. And right now I'm just confused just by the aspect of that happening. And before they even were shot, a lot of people were posturing, you know, reflecting the violence in the hood and trying to envelop that philosophy within their act, which kind of like scared off the rest of the female audience in rap music, at least until Puffy Combs actually has brought it back. So Puffy Combs has brought back the female audience, which is a good thing. But before then, you know, the live shows disappeared with the disappearing of the female audience as they flocked towards R&B.
Do you think that part of the reason why women weren't showing up for rap concerts is the lack of respect they were given in rap music?
No, I think you had a whole bunch of young crooners come by, form of Boyz II Men and Jodeci, and I don't care how much a rapper is rapping, nothing gets a female's attention more than somebody that's on his knees with a rose in his mouth singing love to them.
Well, it is interesting that rap music has had so little in the way of love ballads. I mean, because usually, like, especially in like teenage music, there's such a long history of the romantic ballad, right, along with the more,
people,
you know, aggressive. Yeah, right.
People fall in love every year, you know.
You ever miss that side of performing?
What's that?
The romantic side. Wish that there was, that Chuck D had like a kind of romantic ballad side?
No, I can't sing a lick. I can't play instruments. I yell and I scream. So this would be like comparable to, you know, Led Zeppelin. You know, it's just like, you know, with, I guess, white males, you know, Led Zeppelin or metal rock or straight up rock and roll becomes very energetic and you move around and it becomes athletic.
Even Led Zeppelin would have something like Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah, and I've had some things that brought the tempo down every once in a while, but you know, I believe if you cannot sing, don't even go into that zone. You have people who are natural singers, you have people that have the ability to sing, and that's their chunk of entertainment, and I admire them for that. I mean, I'm a big fan of Motown in the 60s, so, you know, if I want to hear me something slow jam, I'll, you know, turn on something by Otis Redding.
One of your most famous records was used for the soundtrack of Do the Right Thing, and that's Fight the Power,
mm-hmm.
Fight the Powers That Be. What power? Which power do you want people to fight?
The powers in the black community is all those that control the black community from the outside going in. The powers of a lot of different things, economics, education, enforcement, you know, the powers that keep the black community remaining in the plantation state that it remains in. So with that in mind, you want to fight the powers to get that foot off your neck. And that's just your human right, to get a foot off your neck.
What influence do you hope your lyrics have had on your listeners?
To be able to look at information clearly, disseminate it, and then use it for their own good.
One last question. What have you been listening to now, musically?
Me?
Yeah.
I bought this Rhino box set of 100 records from the 60s.
The soul
yeah,
music box?
Yeah, Beg, Scream, Shout.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Bought that. Of course, Hendrix stays in my collection.
Uh-huh.
The first Funkadelic album, Free Your Mind. As for Busta Rhymes. O.C.
Yeah.
O.C. has the latest album. There's a good young rapper that I like.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading Sweet Soul Music.
Peter Guralnick's book?
Yeah, Peter Guralnick's book. I just bought Gladys Knight's book yesterday.
Uh-huh.
High Record Story, which is three sets of CDs on everything out of High Records in Memphis. That's you know, heavily, and also making the next record. So, you know, hearing also Traffic's first couple albums, another group, Traffic, Stevie mm-hmm, Winwood mm-hmm. and all them.
Well, we're out of time. Chuck D, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Terry.
Chuck D is co-founder of Public Enemy. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1997. The next interview in our hip-hop history series is with Sean P. Diddy Combs, a.k.a. Puff Daddy. He's one of the most successful and wealthiest people to have come out of the hip-hop world. He started as a record producer, working with performers like Mary J. Blige and Biggie Smalls. In 1991, he started his own label, Bad Boy Records. Several years after producing hits for others, he started recording his own music. He also has a successful clothing design company, Sean John, his own fragrance, and he acts. He starred in the 2004 Broadway revival, A Raisin in the Sun. He has a new album coming out on September 15th, his first in 17 years. Sean Diddy Combs spoke to Terry Gross in 2008.
Sean Combs, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Now, correct me if I get any facts wrong here, but you grew up in a Harlem housing project until you were about 12, and then you and your mother moved to Mount Vernon, which is just north of New York City. Compare the two neighborhoods for us.
Oh, see, I lived in Harlem, so it's a whole different type of inner city feeling. It's like it helped make me what I was today. It's so soulful. It's a place that's like, you know, rich in culture and soul and fashion and music. You know, everybody is trying to be the best dressed person in the neighborhood. People dance in the streets. You growing up, you in some places, you know, like in the suburbs, kids grow up playing Little League and, you know, in sports. And in Harlem, you grow up dancing and singing and in the world of fashion, just trying to, you know, put your outfits together. And so it kind of shaped and molded me for my future. And the difference of the suburbs, it gave me like that balance, gave me that other side of things. I was able to grow with different races, and you know, also get exposed to like trees and grass and things that a lot of us take for granted, you know. You know, and being able to really actually play, you know, sports in some grass and not just on the street. And you know, it was the best of both worlds.
Your mother sent you to a private Catholic boys' high school. Did you want to go to that school?
Oh, no, I wanted to go where the girls were at. but she knew that would, when I was a child, I always had loved women, just growing up with women. But, you know, she knew that was probably going to be a big distraction for me. My whole life I went to private school and Catholic schools. I was an altar boy, you know, before, you know, I went to high school and stuff like that. So I was kind of used to the nuns and the priests and everything, and just going to school with that type of, you know, strictness. So I wasn't worried about that, but I at least thought that when I got to high school, I was going to get to be around some girls. But that didn't happen. So by the time I got to Howard, and I was at Howard University, and I was finally around some young ladies, I was extremely happy.
You dropped out of Howard University to be an intern at Uptown Records, and you became a vice president in your early 20s. How did you know you wanted to be in the music industry?
Oh, I was, you know, I was looking at like the there was two people from that would be in the neighborhoods that really were the guys we would look up to, and that was either the guy, the street hustler, or, you know, the up and coming like rap star. And so I felt like I wanted to be a football player. I have to back you up a little bit. I wanted to be a football player, but I broke my leg. So then by default, then I wanted to become like a businessman, or, you know, I had a dream to be, you know, in the music business, as an artist, or just in the business. And, you know, I would be casted for music videos because I was a good dancer, and they would come into the clubs and they would just come get you out of the clubs and offer you a chance to be in a music video. And I used to get chosen a lot, and I used to always see the recording artist, but then I would see this other guy that looked like he had, you know, more power and more respect and more money than the recording artist, and that was like the owner of the label or the music mogul executive. And so I was like, I wanted to do that. And so that's what I chose. A lot of people chose at first to become a recording artist. I chose first. I was like, if I could become that guy that's there that the music artist is asking the questions of, then, you know, my chances to finally one day be on the stage, I think my chances would be better going that route first.
How does being on stage on Broadway compared to being on stage in front of a very enthusiastic hip-hop audience?
Yeah, it's just totally different. It's just, you know, acting and, you know, being a musical artist, there are some similarities, but to be honest, they're totally different. You know, and the two stages are totally different. You know, at one place, even though there are times as musical artists, we try to bring, you know, a live theater feel to our concerts. It's nothing like, you know, performing on stage on Broadway for, you know, 2.5-3 hours, and you can almost hear a pin drop in the audience. So you can hear every breath that they take, and you know, performing in front of, like, you know, in Wembley Stadium, because I just don't perform just in front of hip hop audiences. I also perform like in front of, whether it's a rock audience, or when I did the Princess Diana concert at Wembley Stadium, that's like, you know, 60,000 people. It's another level of just impromptu type of freedom and you know, connection with the crowd, of really trying to get them engaged the whole time. You're trying to like pull them in closer and closer and closer to you, so you have this eruption. And so in a sense it is the same thing, but it's just different. So I don't think I answered that question the best way, but it's the best way to answer the question.
When you're on stage on Broadway, you're in character, you're playing somebody else. When you're on stage in concert, do you feel like you're playing somebody else there too? Or do you feel like you're yourself on stage?
You know, I mean, I'm more of myself. I'm not playing like a total different person. Yeah, I mean, a lot of me is on the stage, you know. But there's like maybe 20% that is like just the character that you turn off, you know, when you get off the stage. But a lot of what makes you special if you're a great performer on the musical stage is if you're able to bring yourself to that, and there's something about yourself that's different than all other performers.
You know, you have all these different names that you've used for different things. You know, you're Sean Combs, you're Puff Daddy, you've been P. Diddy. And so I'm wondering, like, if Puff Daddy or P. Diddy has, like, a different personality than Sean Combs, if you see it as, like, a character in a way.
Yeah, it does. They are. I think we as human beings, we have different sides to ourselves. And I just named all those different sides. It wasn't, you know, that I was. And it was something that with the name thing, it was just like, it's just having fun. It's not, a lot of people ask the question, it's not a serious thing. Like, so I answer to any of my five names. So it's not to confuse you. But yeah, it's definitely different sides of my personality.
Now, your first hit under your own name was about your friend Biggie Smalls, who was gunned down a few feet away from you in 1997. It was a kind of goodbye to him. You were so close. I don't want to get too personal here, but what impact did his murder have on your life, the reality of violence in your world like that, somebody you were so close to being shot in front of you?
Yeah. You know, I lost my father that way, and then, you know, losing him, you know, one of my best friends, and then after that, I lost two more of my best friends, all to the same way. They were all shot and killed. It's a tragedy that, to be honest, this is something that, you know, growing up in the inner city, it's almost like you're prepared for it. It's almost strange when you have a friend who's a black male die of, like, cancer or something. It's almost normal when you hear, when you get the call or you witness somebody or a friend of yours get shot and killed. And it was just as devastating, no matter what it is, to lose somebody that you love. But, you know, the tragedy is that it's almost like a lot of us, depends on where we grow up, it's like we're prepared for things like that. And that's something that I feel has to change in this world.
You know, some people say rap glorifies violence, or glorified violence back in the 80s and 90s. You know, particularly, and that rap made violence seem like the authentic way of being African American. And other people say, no, rap just reflected the violence that was out there. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I feel it was a reflection. And also, I feel like at points it definitely was glorified, but it was a true reflection. But, you know, then It was like, because you couldn't get away from it, okay, well, if I'm in this situation, at least I'm going to be the baddest that was ever in this situation. And then there have been times in the music it has been glorified.
Well, I'd like to play the first hit that you had under your name, and it was an homage to Biggie Smalls and about how much you missed him. It's called I'll Be Missing You. And I'm not sure if it's a sample or just like musicians playing the riff.
You know, it's a sample.
It's a sample. Okay.
It's a Sting.
From the Police, Every Breath You Take.
Yes.
So let's hear it. This is my guest, Sean Combs. And you recorded this under Puff Daddy, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Here it is.
This right here, tell me why, goes out to everyone. Lost someone that they truly love. Come on, check it out. Seems like yesterday we used to rock the show. I laced the track, you locked the flow. So far from hanging on the block of dough. Notorious, they got to know that life ain't always what it seemed to be. Words can't express what you mean to me. Even though you're gone, we still a team. Through your family, I'll fulfill your dreams. In the future, can't wait to see if you open up the gates for me. Reminisce sometime, the night they took my friend. Try to black it out, but it plays again. When it's real, feeling's hard to conceal. Can't imagine all the pain I feel. Give anything to hear half your breath. I know you're still living your life after death.
Every step I take, every move I make.
My guest is Sean Combs, Puff Daddy, and that was his first hit. A shout out to his late friend Biggie Smalls. So, you know, in addition to music and acting, you also have your fashion company, Sean John, and your label. And now I read that your grandmother was a seamstress. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. That my grandmother, she was the neighborhood seamstress. And so when I was growing up, I didn't realize that that's one of the ways I was going to get kind of my preparation to become a designer. But, you know, I used to, you know, assist her in the house, you know, cut the patterns and, you know, help, you know, press things and get things to be ready to be delivered. And, you know, it gave me a sense of understanding detail and fit on a garment. And I didn't realize that at that time that, you know, it would come to some use as I got older.
You know, it's interesting. I think, you know, like some boys and young teenagers would think of that as being too feminine, you know, anything associated with sewing.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously that didn't bother you.
Yeah, no, it didn't bother me. I've always been comfortable in who I was and, you know, and it was cool with me. My mother, she was making me take guitar lessons, and she tried to get me in some ballet classes and tap dance. So I had to get over the whole worrying about if something was feminine early, you know, with my mother. She wanted to make sure I was well-rounded, so I got past that early.
Did you take tap or ballet?
Yeah, I took tap and ballet for like 2 days.
But you ended up being a dancer.
Yes, yeah, I ended up doing tap dancing. But the ballet was just a little too hard for me. I'm not really that flexible neither.
So, with your grandmother, did you actually learn things that you can use as a designer now, or as,
yeah,
you know,
yes, definitely. She taught me about fit, and she taught me about attention to detail. Just being there with her, you know, the way she was a perfectionist about making sure every garment was perfect.
Did she make clothes for you?
Yes, she made all my clothes on Easter Sunday was made by my grandmother.
Now, the great thing about having a relative make clothes for you is that you're going to have something that's unique. The not-so-great thing is if you want to look like everybody else, you won't.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to buy, like, whatever the popular brand is, yeah, it isn't your grandmother's brand.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think that separates the leaders from the followers. And I always wanted to be a trendsetter, so I always wanted to wear something that nobody could get. I always wanted a one-of-a-kind piece from when I was, like, 6 years old, so...
Can you describe one of the greatest things she made you?
Yeah, she had made me. It was like it was a navy blue suit with gold buttons. It was a 3-piece suit, and I mean, you know, back in those days, like the gold buttons used to have the accents, and so yeah, I remember that. That was for Easter. That was one Easter Sunday.
Well, just one last question. How much sleep do you get a night?
I would say like 5 hours, 4 hours.
Can you run on that? I mean, do you have insomnia, or you're just too busy to sleep?
Yeah, no, I have insomnia. That, you know,
but and you so you put when you can't sleep. You
no,
put
I don't.
That
I
use?
Don't have insomnia.
You don't have insomnia. I do, but you got
to watch what you say. So I don't have insomnia. I don't want to put that out on that. I'm going to change that up. I don't have it anymore. I just got cured today.
Hey, congratulations!
thank you very much. I don't have insomnia anymore tonight. I'm going to sleep great.
Good luck. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sean Diddy Combs spoke to Terry Gross in 2008. Let's close with the Biggie song, Mo Money, Mo Problems. It was produced by Sean Diddy Combs, and Diddy raps on the track. The song is built on a sample of Diana Ross's 1980 disco anthem, I'm Coming Out.
Tell me who rock, who sell out in the stores. You tell me who flop, who cop the blue drop, who jewels got blocks, who mostly doji down to the blue drop. The same old pimp, Mace, you know ain't nothing changed but my limp. Can't stop till I see my name on a blimp. Guarantee me and shells full of love, luck. You don't believe in Harlem World? Double up. We don't play around, it's a bet, lay it down. Didn't know me 91, bet they know me now.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krinzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Susan Nyakundi. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm Tanya Mosley.
See me die than to see me fly. I call all the shots, rip all the spots, rock all the rocks, top all the drops. I know you think.